engagement and sponsors of this radio station.
You're listening to American Radio with Dave Champion.
Well, thank you for staying with us in hour number two. As I told you at the top of the show, hour number two, very special guest. His name is Larry Becraft. He's an attorney out of Alabama, and his most recent point of notoriety, but by far not his only point of notoriety, is he was the lead attorney in the case of Bernice Kugelin, the gal back east, 58-year-old pilot for FedEx, who was indicted on 6 counts of willful failure to file. I believe she hadn't filed since 1995. She'd been asking the government for years to tell her where the law was that made her liable or to file a tax return. And the government, as listeners to this show know, the government had remained silent. Very, very common. One of the big problems that we're having right now with government is that when things aren't looking favorable to them, their answer now is, we're not going to say anything, but we will remind you we have guns in prisons. And that's the approach they took with Bernice, and I'm not going to go into the case right now because we're going to discuss that with our guests. But let me tell you a little bit about Larry Becraft. He is from Huntsville, Alabama. He attended Samford University at Lakeshore Drive, Birmingham, Alabama, graduated with honors, obtained a bachelor degree of science in business administration, economics. He then went on to the Cumberland School of Law at Samford University in Birmingham, Alabama, and he graduated with a Juris Doctorate degree. He's been admitted to the bar in Alabama. He practices in various states. He practices before various circuits of the federal courts as well as state courts. Some of the noteworthy things that he has done: he represented the lead defendant, Franklin Saunders, in what was arguably the largest tax trial in American history. It went on from January through July. There were 27 defendants, and in the end, all of the defendants were acquitted of all the charges brought against them. As I said before, most recently, the United States v. Bernice Kugelin, obviously a high point in his career. And one of the things that's important to Larry, and I'm going to want to talk to him more about this, is his involvement since 1998 with DVKID and when they created something called the Wallace Institute. The Wallace Institute focuses on preparing litigation on a number of socially important issues. One of the things it focuses on is litigating federal laws that are made in pursuance of treaties, which is something we really need to talk about more in detail on this show. And that's I'm very, very pleased to know that Larry's involved in that. Now, on the board of directors of the Wallace Institute, just so you know, is Jeff Metcalf, who is a very popular talk show host in San Francisco, retired General Ben Parton, and two other retired judges. So Larry's obviously very busy. He's got a lot of things going on. Does a lot of excellent work, and he supports things that are very important to the American people. We're very glad to have him. Larry, thank you for being on American Radio.
Dave, it's a pleasure to be with you.
Always nice to talk to you again, buddy. Haven't spoken to you in a little bit.
How are things in Palmdale?
Hot. What can I say?
I can imagine.
I think driving in was about 101 today. It's not too bad.
Oh, gee.
How's things there?
Oh, well, it's cool, but today is the first day of football season, so...
Now, well, fall is coming.
That makes it better.
Yeah, you guys actually have seasons there.
Yes, we do.
Yeah, that's something we miss out here in California.
Well, no, I remember a couple of years ago, I used to go out to Palmdale, but, y'all had some snow there, it seems like a year or two ago, 6 inches or something like that, wasn't it?
Yeah, every once in a while we get those fluke flurries out here. Hey, I've got a question for you. On the bio... I just really had to laugh at this. One of the things says that Larry has been a speaker on many right-wing patriot conventions. My condolences.
Well, that's to distinguish me from appearing before crowds like, Democrats or, the Hillary-type crowd.
Yeah. I just
the Clintons.
I just really love the description, right-wing patriot.
Well, I'm a quantum leaps to the right of a whole lot of people, so...
Yes.
Some of these crowds are kind of tame, though.
Yeah, I don't know whether I classify myself as right, but certainly I clearly am not left.
Constitutionalist, I think, is the correct term.
I think that was until the media slaughtered that one, too. I think, for instance, Clarence Thomas and Antonin Scalia have now, since, of course, all those terms have been drugged through the mud by the media, they've now coined it originalist.
Yes.
So that would be you and me.
Well, just as long as the theory, the legal theory, that I am not following is that of the living Constitution.
Exactly. The original Constitution.
Right.
Now, you know, one of the things I noticed that was missing here, as I read through the bio, were you not counsel on Lloyd Long?
Yes, uh-huh.
Yeah, I was 99.9% sure.
Yeah, I was. You know, okay. I don't list, in that thing I sent to you, I didn't list everything I've done. You know, if you want war stories, I can tell you a lot of war stories.
Well, I think the reason that Lloyd Long stands out is I think that was one of the, correct me if I'm wrong, you've been looking at the legal side of this before I even knew there was a tax honesty movement. I think that was really the first big public win. Would you agree?
Well, no, I've been involved in this thing. You know, I got involved with the freedom movement, let's call it that. Tupper Saucy is the fellow that brought me into it back in 1979, so I've been here ever since. You know, I've made my own contributions to the movement. I've done a lot of research and thrown out a lot of ideas. But, you know, there have been a lot of, a lot of people that would have come in as a result of, you know, around the time of Phil Marsh. Phil Marsh in the early 90s kind of got things rolling, and that's what brought a lot of people into the movement, and that'd be the first time people found out anything about a tax case. When we got through with the Lloyd Long case, I just came home and I said goodbye to, you know, he had picked me up, the trial was real close in Chattanooga, and we drove back, didn't have a car in Chattanooga, and, you know, we just said goodbye then, and, you know, I thought that was the end of the Lloyd Long thing, and then somebody ordered the transcript, and, you know, it became a folk legend on its own.
It did, and I got to tell you a funny story. When I first came to be aware of the tax honesty movement, there was an organization, I'm not going to name it, you probably know who it is, and they were selling this like 2.5-inch thick book that was sort of spiral-bound, and it was a transcript of the Lloyd Long case. And just, Larry, to give you some kudos, I read through that entire transcript front to back, and it was one of the pivotal documents that told me more than a decade ago that what the tax honesty movement was talking about was true. You listen to him and you listen to what the government has to say and you listen to the artful way that you had him testify, and there is no question.
Well, you know, preparation of a witness to testify at a trial is real important. And, you know, I kind of think it shows up in Lloyd, but, you know, there's a lot of other people that have put a lot of hard work into preparing for trial and getting ready to testify. There is this erroneous impression that flows through the freedom movement, the tax movement, that, you know, hey, if I get indicted today, let's try the case tomorrow. You know, I've never seen that is a very sound proposition. You know, I find that most people need to they got to build their timeline. They got to reread the stuff that they read initially. You know, they got to put their thoughts back up out of the subconscious into the conscious mind, and then they got to learn how to express themselves. And that's difficult. You know, for people that have never had any public speaking experience, you know, communicating to a jury of 12 people that are sitting there, you know, just a little bit beyond your arm, can be difficult. Those with public speaking experience find such a circumstance something that they can easily handle. But, you know, everybody's got a little bit different skill in getting ready to get on the stand, and Lloyd was a good speaker, and so he had the ability to convey his thoughts.
Yes.
The same thing with Vernie Coogan. You know, she had experience in public speaking.
Right. And you know, from what I read of Lloyd, I mean, I wasn't there. I couldn't hear the energy with which he delivered it. But just broken down the text, he did a great job.
Okay.
Now, let's talk about Vernice Coogan for a moment. And since we were talking about Lloyd Long, let's use that as a little segue. Any similarity in tactics?
Well, you know, they're both from Tennessee, and they both kind of relied upon certain basic legal arguments that are particular for people in Tennessee. For example, and you know the excise tax argument.
Oh, yes.
You know, the case in Tennessee that was decided back in 1960, the Jack Cole against McFarland case, is a real good one. Supportive of the excise tax argument. Back in 1960, you know, the Supreme Court of Tennessee basically held that an excise tax couldn't be used to tax the right to earn a living. And, you know, that's the reason why in Tennessee there is no federal income tax, or a state income tax. But, you know, people that are in Tennessee, they find, you know, if they get off into, you know, well, I believe that the income tax is an excise tax, which is real easy once you read the Bruchhaber case, And then it's real simple for them to say, well, gee, what is an excise tax? And then they read the Jack Cole against McFarland case, and they say an excise tax can't be used to tax the right to earn a living. And boom, you know, things kind of fall into real quick perspective. You know, it's real easy to, you know, logically see how the income tax operates with, you know, just reading Bruce Schreiber and then reading the Jack Cole against McFarland case. And that's what both of them did. You know, that was their introduction. And, you know, I consider arguments like that to have the ability to communicate with a jury.
Right. Now, when you met Vernice, where was she at in the process?
I didn't know Vernice until I got a call from her after she had been indicted.
Okay.
And, but when I finally got to meet her, I learned that I had met her about 10 years ago. And in fact, one of the very first meetings that she had attended was a meeting that was held over in Atlanta, Georgia. You know, I kind of remember in the back of my mind having met her on that occasion. You know, I didn't talk taxes on that occasion. I talked about treaties, which you mentioned a minute ago. But, you know, Vernice went to that meeting, and, you know, it's odd that, you know, I was at the very first meeting where she started digging into the tax issues and where she was beginning to develop the beliefs that ultimately resulted in her stand.
Right.
And then 10 years later, you know, I happened to end up representing her.
Now, when she came to you and said, Larry, I've been indicted, and here's my story. Now I know for you, there's no knee-jerk reaction. You don't just say, well, great, let's go do this. It's contemplated, and you map out what you want to do. But what were the first rough thoughts that came to mind on how you wanted to defend Vernice, and did you actually follow through on that initial plan?
Well, let me just kind of give you a rough idea as to what I do when somebody's been indicted. You know, first, you know, it was nice that it was in Memphis. You know, that's one of the closest cases I've had close to home in a long time. You know, so I could just pick up. It's just a three-hour drive over to Memphis. You know, boom, I could run over there, you know, for whatever situation came up. You know, a lot of my cases are a lot further away.
Sure.
You know, the closest thing I've got, well, I've got one up in Nashville coming up soon, but, you know, I've got one up in Roanoke, Virginia. You know, that's an 8 and 10 hour drive. But what I do when somebody calls me and I end up representing them, the first thing I do is I just sit down and have a chat with them to determine what their beliefs are. Now, you know, like you, Dave, you know, you know all the tax arguments just off the top of your head. And, you know, I know all the tax arguments, so I kind of, you know, it takes me a couple of minutes to assess what their beliefs are. And then after that, you know, I get to the government discovery and take a look at what their case is. And then I have the client start building the timeline. You know, this is real important for somebody that's getting ready to testify.
Now, hold on right there, because we're up against the clock. We are with Larry Beecraft, the winning attorney in United States v. Kuglin, and we'll be right back.
Glucosamine sulfate is in a class of compounds called amino sugars. It's one of the starting points of tissue development, including cartilage, ligaments, tendons, and the structure around blood vessels. Low levels of glucosamine sulfate can cause tissue weakness and arthritis. Daniel Chapter 1's GS1500 is their glucosamine sulfate designed for your body to use immediately. Besides reducing swelling and inflammation, it also helps maintain healthy skin, eyes, hair, and nails. For keeping the softer body tissues in supreme condition, you won't find anything on the market better than Daniel Chapter 1's GS1500. Their merchandise is made from and inspired by God-given nutrients. Daniel Chapter 1's GS1500 and other all-natural products. Call 800-504-5511 and ask for their new bio guide. That's 1-800-504-5511. Accent Radio Network wants to hear from you. You're the reason why we're here. Any opinion or suggestions are greatly appreciated. You can call in to any and all of our talk shows on the 866-2-ACCENT number. That's toll-free, 866-222-2368. If you'd rather just write us and give a comment or feedback, go to the website at www.accentradionetwork.com. That's all one word, accentradionetwork.com. To mail letters to us, our physical address is Accent Radio Network, Post Office Box 155, McAlpin, Florida 32062. That's P.O. Box 155, MCALPIN, McAlpin, Florida 32062. Thanks again for your support and listening to Accent Radio Network. Are you concerned with what you eat and drink? Do you find yourself reading the ingredients of everything you buy and still not know whether you're consuming harmful contaminants? Are we all going to become farmers and chemists, testing our soil and water supplies to reassure ourselves of their purity? Of course not. That wouldn't be realistic. We can't watch everything we eat. It doesn't mean we can't do something about it, though. Daniel Chapter 1's BioMix is the answer. It's a chocolate-flavored mix that cleans blood naturally and is a great immune system booster. BioMix blends easily in water or your favorite drink and helps restore cells that have been damaged during chemotherapy and radiation treatments. Whether you're making sure your body is on an even keel or combating cancer and the deadly effects of allopathic eradication, make BioMix an essential part of your body maintenance program. Call Daniel Chapter 1 and order BioMix today. 800-504-5511. 800-504-5511 for all natural BioMix.
American Radio, revealing the American Matrix.
At 22 after the hour, we are back with our very special guest, Larry Beecraft. And Larry, before we go back to the timeline issue, which is exactly where we left, I have to sort of just share a little humor with you. As you talk, I'm writing some notes, and you said that you and I both know all the tax arguments, and I've got a note down here, valid and invalid.
Yeah.
Knowing all of them doesn't make them all right.
That's true.
All right, so timeline.
Well, let's talk about how people get involved in the movement.
Sure.
You know, some people get involved in the movement because they've got a tax problem. Others are curious and, you know, they want to investigate the tax and, you know, they hear all this talk and if there's some financial benefit from getting involved, they get involved. But then there are others that get involved for, you know, doing something right for the country. But inevitably what happens, you know, when people make a decision to become associated with the tax movement some way, they start their study. And they watch videotapes, they attend meetings, they buy books, you know, they start reading, they get the Internal Revenue Code, they check out some of these theories, they go to the law library.
They listen to American radio.
and then after that, then they make their decision. And then after that, they start their battle with the IRS once law enforcement comes along, be it civil or criminal. Now, you know, that's a way that a lot of people take. You know, one of the things I think that's real important for people to understand is I'm going to give it an observation of what I think is going on with a lot of people. A lot of people have reached a point where they say, for whatever reason, you know, whatever their reasons are, they've had it with abusive government. You know, it's just, you know, to the point where they don't want to take it anymore.
Amen.
They want to do something about it. But after that, it becomes a very emotional issue for a lot of people. You know, it's their one-man war against the government.
Yeah, brains and intellect be damned.
Yeah, and you know, this is the way human nature operates. You know, people say, I've had it up to here, and I'm going to go out and strike out on their own. Well, you know, unless the people, you know, it's going to take something more than just everybody engaging in their one man battle against the government. Unless there's some type of unity involved, you know, this is going to be repeating. You know, the next 20 years is going to be like the last 20 years I've experienced. There is a better way to approach this overall tax battle other than what the route that most people take.
Yeah, and you and I have talked about that privately.
Yeah, but moving back to Vernie Kuglin, you know, what she had done is she had gone through that same old experience as everyone else. You know, they start reading the tax materials that are floating around. You know, they say this stuff was voluntary compliance, and that intrigues a lot of people. Then they start listening to some of these people that are talking about taxes, and they begin to, you know, they sink their teeth into some of the basic arguments, and then they do some of the basic study regarding the tax code itself, and then they, you know, they get up to a certain point where they say, hey, I'm going to make a stand, and that's what Vernie did. You know, she went for 3 years without filing returns, but being subjected to withholding with her employer. Then she finally got around in the fall of 95 writing some letters to the IRS asking two basic questions and also asking for answers to her questions. She wanted to know the section of the code that made her liable for the federal income tax, and she wanted to know what statute required her to specifically fill out a 1040 form. Two simple little questions. And
well, we
when
know,
she got
we know
no
that
answer,
was...
that's when she decided to go, you know, exempt.
Well, we know those two questions were way too much for the IRS.
Absolutely. You know, the government can't answer those questions. You know, there's only one section of the code that makes anybody liable for the federal income tax. That's 1461, and that's the withholding agent for non-resident aliens and foreign corporations. And that is very critical. You know, that's a critical part of the overall picture regarding the federal income tax.
Indeed it is.
Yeah, it's very, very profound. But Bernie, when she quit filing returns, and ultimately 3 years later when she quit subjecting herself to withholding, you know, time went by, and then the IRS would come along, and they did things like send her notices of deficiency, and so she had, you know, an ongoing battle with the IRS, and she joined an organization and had that organization assist her in this letter-writing campaign with the IRS. Ultimately, however, she was indicted. Now, here's one point I want to make a correction on Dave. She wasn't indicted for willful to file. She was indicted for tax evasion, a felony.
Okay.
And, you know, here you got a lady that's at the zenith of her career with a major airline company. And, you know, she gets indicted in March of this year. And, you know, she got the butterflies just like anybody else. But over a couple of meetings with her, you know, I'd go over there and stay in Memphis, and we'd work on the case. She ultimately decided, hey, I started this battle. I'm going to take my stand. And she was committed to it, and she worked on her testimony. She went through her documents. She went through her materials that she read and studied, and she worked on her testimony. And there's a lot of time that goes into that.
Oh,
and
you bet.
You know, ultimately she made the decision, I'm not going to do anything but go to trial.
You know,
and we went to trial, and there was a favorable verdict.
And you know, many people become exposed to the movement and choose not to go any further than the initial exposure, because of the time requirements to learn what's going on.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. Okay, so she studied all her materials, and now, is it true that I hear that the government tried to plea bargain her and she'd have none of it?
No, I don't, you know, I think that's kind of, that's a rumor that Carl Warden started. There wasn't anything to that. You know, one of the things I do is, you know, as soon as I get some type of information from the government as to the claimed or alleged tax loss, you know, I consult the guidelines and make a rough calculation as to the cost of going to trial. Now, in 1984, effective in 1987, you know, the federal system went over to scientific sentencing, and that's what we call the guidelines. And what the guidelines do is, you know, they give you know, there's a workup. In the event of a conviction, there's a workup. You know, it's all based on points. Once you determine the points, you know, like if you got a prior criminal history, that adds points to the, you know, the ultimate sentence that will be imposed. You know, if you have a small amount of tax loss in a tax case, you know, your sentence is less than if you have a very large claim tax loss. So for Bernie Kugler, with the government sitting there and saying that there was $250,000 in alleged tax loss, you know, all you have to do is pull out the guidelines, and I did so with Bernie. And told her what the cost of going to trial. You know, I think it for $250,000, that is a guideline range of 33 to 36 months. And you know, so that was the ultimate sentence that she was looking at. And we never really asked the government for any plea offer, or you know, the only thing we did is I just simply found out what the tax loss was and told Bernie, and she said, "Hey, I'm moving ahead."
All right. Well, we're facing another break, so hang in there. Let's talk about what really happened. A lot of rumors about this stuff, so we'll talk about what really happened when we get back. I'm Dave Champion. This is American Radio. We'll be right back.
This is Newsbreak. The United States is condemning a car bombing in Iraq. About 100 people have been killed at last report. President Bush has issued a statement calling the attack a vicious act of terrorism. Among the dead in the Holy City, Iraq's most prominent Shiite cleric supportive of the U.S., Ayatollah Mohammed Bakr al-Hakim. Officials in France say that more than 11,000 people died as a result of the historic heat wave in that country. Many factors are to blame for such a high number of deaths, one of which is the scarcity of air conditioning there. During the heat wave, France's temperature soared to unprecedented heights, over 104 degrees. The World Trade Organization has given the okay for poorer countries to import cheaper medications to fight diseases such as AIDS and malaria. This Labor Day weekend, as all other Labor Day weekends have been, is one of the busiest travel weekends of the year. AAA says that 33.4 million people will travel this three-day weekend, most of those in their cars. This is Cynthia King.
Can't lose weight? Tried all the latest fad diets, but nothing seems to work? Listen to what these ThermoCarb users are saying about their experiences.
When I got to be a size 14, I said enough was enough. I tried the ThermoCarb, and I lost 30 pounds in 4 months, and I feel great, and now I'm down to a size 4.
I smoked for about 5-6 years, and I put on about 35 pounds since I stopped smoking. I've been on ThermoCarb now for about 5 weeks, lost close to 12 pounds, about an inch and a half off my waist. Thanks, ThermoCarb.
I dropped 15 pounds the first month, 25 pounds in 3 months. I lost 3 dress sizes and feel great.
So if you thought losing weight had to be difficult, then you haven't tried ThermoCarb. ThermoCarb is natural, clinically proven, and is so effective that you can lose up to 21 pounds or 2 to 3 dress or pant sizes per month guaranteed. So call now for your 60-day risk-free trial. Call toll-free 1-800-245-8910. That's 1-800-245-8910. That's 1-800-245-8910.
Health Facts Minute, brought to you by DanielChapter1.com. Some look back to see where they're heading. Tracing your family tree has become quite popular. Following your lineage may be more helpful than just satisfying personal curiosity. Between 5 and 10% of people diagnosed with cancer are predisposed through inherited abnormal genes. This percentage could be higher than 55,000 people a year in the U.S. alone. That's not to say we're vulnerable or more at risk because of our ancestry. We all can help prevent contracting other forms of cancer. Consuming less chemicals and avoided extended exposure to sunlight is helpful. Most important is keeping your immune system in tip-top shape by exercise and eating foods high in calcium and antioxidants on a daily basis. Elderly people should follow this advice even more so, since age is also a factor in weakening immune systems. This Health Facts Minute has been brought to you by DanielChapter1.com.
People typically don't like lawyers. That's because lawyers usually don't deal in truth. They deal in deceit. That's no less true of lawyers in government, which unfortunately includes most of our elected officials. To find out how these unscrupulous men and women have been intentionally undermining our liberty for decades, visit Original Intent at www.originalintent.org. Original Intent, restoring the Republic, one citizen at a time.
After doing the legal research, I've determined I don't have any federal or state income tax liability. But if you're like me, knowing the facts and knowing what to do about them are two different things. That's why I'm so glad my husband and I found nontaxpayer.org. We've achieved our dream of living happily as non-taxpayers. It's nice to do what's right and have peace of mind.
Nontaxpayer.org does not provide services to taxpayers.
Call American Radio toll free at 888-987-3100.
Hey, Larry, you're not one of those unscrupulous lawyers, okay?
Oh, don't worry about that. I know that's what you're talking about. There's that, a big problem with government.
You know, that commercial was lined up in the queue, and when it started to play, we all started laughing. So it's not you. We're not talking about you, buddy. All right, so where were we? We're going to talk about, you know, the rumors. Now,
you had a question. You said, well, what happened next? You know, that's what I thought.
Right, and then I talked about rumors. Now, you threw out the figure $250,000. The press releases I have seen in the news articles, national and local, talking $920,000. Where'd that figure come from?
No, that was her salary.
Okay.
You know, so there was 5 years or six counts of tax evasion, so we have 6 years that were in question here. And, you know, Bernie would do overtime and, you know, stuff like that. So, you know, as I recall, I don't have the chart in front of me, but, you know, 1 year she might have made $170,000, but then the following year $140,000. But, you know, she was definitely somebody that made had a good salary, a very good salary, and she was somebody that the government could paint to be like Leona Helmsley. They like to pick defendants that are in that position.
Interesting. All right. So now what happened? You start edging towards trial.
Well, let me kind of bring people up to speed. This is one thing I want to say to those that are involved in the tax movement. You know, there are a lot of issues involved in the tax movement. And you also got to understand what you're going to be able to accomplish. And I've been trying cases, criminal cases, for I don't know how long, you know, since I've been out of law school. But, you know, there's certain things that we are going to be able to accomplish in the federal criminal tax trials, and there are certain things that they're not. Plus, there's a tremendous amount of things that need to be done. You know, and a lot of people want to think that, well, you know, I've got my little tax argument in my head, and gee, let's throw that out there and make this thing go away. Well, it doesn't work that way. And there's a big misunderstanding on the people that are involved in the movement and what it takes in order to do something in court in reference to a legal argument. But Bernie was indicted back in, I think, 1st of April. We were on the docket for June, and then we came up again at the end of June. So we finally, by the end of June, we set it down for an August trial date. Well, on the about 4 or 5 days before trial, or maybe a week before trial, we had a docket call over in Memphis, and there were about 35 or 40 cases on that docket. You know, and I was sitting there, and I was just waiting for the judge to call in. But I was sitting there watching all these drug cases and everything else that were coming up, and you know, they're either getting continuances or the people are taking pleas, or and suddenly, you know, the judge says, "Well, gee, y'all are the first case we got for trial that week." And then by the time I left the courtroom, the judge was saying, gee, I think y'all are the only case we're going to have for the trial. And there was a 2 week, you know, the judges set aside 2 weeks for trial. So these, you know, whatever cases went to trial during this 2 week period. Ultimately, what the way it came down is that we were the only trial for that 2 week period. And therefore, you know, I kind of like it in that situation when the judge is not under pressure to, you know, gee, let's move this case out of the way and I want to move on to the next one. And because there wasn't that pressure on the part of the judge, you know, when we got rolling in the trial, you know, when you pick a jury in the federal systems, you know, they can be real quick. But we took a day to pick the jury in this case. Now, let me tell you some of the things that came up. You know, when you're picking the jury, they bring in 35 or 40 different people. In a case where there's a felony charge, you know, the defense has 10 peremptory strikes and the government has 6. And so we're sitting there, you know, this judge allowed us to ask questions. A lot of federal judges will do all the asking of the questions themselves. But so there was kind of a blend between the court asking questions and the lawyers asking questions of the potential jurors. But since this judge had time on his hands, you know, one of the things he did, he did take the time to kind of get jurors accustomed to the courtroom, you know, which I think is kind of nice. But one of the things that, you know, he kind of went through this little questioning of the jurors about, you know, gee, what should the parties get in the way of a juror that sits on this case? And, you know, he asked them, well, gee, should they be prejudiced or should they be open-minded? And, you know, that was the type of, he wanted the jury to know that, you know, gee, these are the things you got to be when you're sitting on a jury. Mm-hmm. But one of the first things he did is the jurors are sitting there in the box and around the courtroom, and they ask this little lady that was sitting in seat number one, you know, pick out the defendant. Now, none of those jurors knew anything, you know, they were just looking at some people sitting around two tables. And so one of them gets popped with the question, pick out the defendant. Who do you think it is? Well, the lady that answered that question pointed to the lady special agent in the case. You know, I kind of thought that was, to me, that was funny, you know, to have a juror pick out who looks the most guilty.
Right, right.
It was the special agent. But, you know, we picked the jury, and then after we picked the jury, you know, we had opening arguments. And what I like to do and opening arguments is you got to kind of paint the case to the jury from the viewpoint of you got to give them something that they can accept. Now, the typical American does not accept the views of the tax movement. You know, there's a lot of people running around the tax movement. You know, I go and speak at FIJA conventions. You know, FIJA supports jury nullification.
Right.
Well, let me just tell you, in tax cases, we are suffering from nullification. Because most of those jurors don't want to do anything. Hey, this guy isn't paying right here. I pay. He doesn't. He goes to jail. And it doesn't matter what type of arguments and reasons that you offer to the jury. There's a tremendous amount of prejudice.
And you sure as hell can't present the information you need to in a couple of days of trial.
Well, you know, one of the things you got to take into consideration is, you know, you got to follow the KISS principle. Keep it simple. And a lot of people want to sit there and just go through all this mountain of tax stuff. Now, what you're going to have to do is you're going to have to get to the heart of the matter. You got to know what the case is about. And you have to have the theme. You know, this is what a lawyer does. A trial lawyer will look at all the facts. Well, what do I think is the theme of this case? And then you got to kind of pound on the theme. And, you know, that's what I do. You know, look at the facts. And to me, the theme in this case was, you know, she was somebody that had no criminal record. You know, she was just like anybody else, except, you know, she made big bucks. She pulled herself up by the bootstraps. She worked her way into her job. You know, that's something a lot of people don't know. You know, she paid for her own education about how to fly planes, and then she became a pilot teacher herself. And then she finally moved up, got better and better jobs until she finally ends up with a very prominent air carrier. Well, the theme of the case is real important because it's got to be something that the typical American is going to be able to understand. And that's the reason why, you know, arguments like, you know, well, where's the section that makes me liable or something else is at least palatable to these people. You know, going through cases and, you know, pointing out the big features of the income tax, that's what's important because that is all a typical jury is going to be able to understand. You can't walk in there for somebody that's been studying the tax laws for 10 and 12 years and then proceed to lay out something extremely complicated and expect the jury to listen to it and comprehend it all. It simply will not happen. You know, I've learned that from experience. So, you know, you got to follow the KISS principle, and that's what I do. Even though there is a lot that you can say in a case, you know, you end up, you know, biting your tongue and you have to say, no, I'm not going to say this. And in fact, a lot of the times I'll reach a certain point in the trial, you know, I kind of like, where is this crescendo? Where is the case, you know, coalescing? What is the high point? And boy, once I reach that high point, you know, I decide, boy, now it's time to shut this case down. You end on the high note and boom, we're ready to close. And, you know, that's my approach to trying some of these cases. But, you know, Bernie had some real good arguments. You know, what section makes me liable for the federal income tax? You know, I believe that it is an excise tax, and I simply followed what the Tennessee Supreme Court said in reference to an excise tax. It can't be used to tax the right to earn a living. And those were some of the major points. You know, we also had other exhibits. When Bernie got on the stand, you know, what I do with a witness is, you know, all the jurors, after they hear the government side of the case, they're going to want to know, well, gee, why did you do this? Even if they are or are not, don't have any real intentions of really listening, you know, that's the most important thing. And a lot of people in tax trials, they're so uncertain of their position, they sit there, I want to issue a subpoena to the president. I want Roscoe Wegner to come in, you know, blah, 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 blah. You know, those people are the ones who want to subpoena the entire world to drag into court. Those are the ones that have no confidence in their ability to persuade a jury, or they have no confidence in their own position. You know, to me, after the jury hears what the government has to say in the way of its own case, which is, gee, this party didn't file, and gee, this party made so much money, and gee, they wrote these letters to the IRS. You know, after that evidence is presented, the jury wants to know why. And you stick the witness, you stick your client up there on the stand, and that's one of the first things I ask. You know, after you do some introductory stuff, why did you do this? And boom, that sets you off on the course for these people to tell their stories.
Okay, got a question for you. The two questions that Bernice had asked the government in her letters, did the government make any attempt whatsoever to answer those questions?
No, they didn't. And even though, you know, when Bernie got on the stand, you know, in discovery, you get to see what the government is going to offer during its case. However, there are certain things you know that they don't have to give to you in discovery. And that's the category where I put, you know, they got some impeachment stuff. You know, like letters. And, you know, there have been some tax court proceedings. There have been an issue to notice of deficiency against Bernie and all this other stuff. You know, I was expecting that to come out on cross. And, you know, Bernie was prepared for, you know, that aspect of cross. But what happened was the government dropped the ball and they didn't really get into those matters. You know, they didn't bring up a lot of points. But, you know, that's the government's choice. You know, they can listen to the, I think the government was traveling too much in this case upon, geez, she's an airline pilot and she makes big money and she owes $250,000 in taxes.
And she's not paying and all the jurors are.
Oh yeah. That's the flavor that that was their theme.
Now, I got an email, and I don't know if it's true, and I'm not going to read the whole thing, but it contends that the author of the email spoke to one of the jurors and to Bernice at a Libertarian Party meeting shortly after the acquittals. And it says that in discussions with this juror, when they went into deliberations, there were three jurors that wanted to acquit and nine jurors that wanted to convict.
Oh, yeah.
And it was these three jurors who basically said to the other nine, the government, in everything they put on, hasn't answered the questions Bernice asked, which is, what makes me liable? What makes me file a 1040? And that these three turned the other nine. Any truth to that?
Absolutely true.
Okay.
You know, the first vote for the jury was three for acquittals and the rest for convictions. By the end of the day, that was up to five. The split was 5-7. You know, the majority still going for a conviction. And on the following day, you know, it turned. The jury did come back at the end of the day, you know, said, gee, we're hopelessly deadlocked. You know, the judge said, no, we'll come back tomorrow. Well, you know, on by Friday, you know, seven of those jurors came over to Bernie's side, and then they came back and voted for acquittal.
Well, it sounds to me like there was you know, a handful of very sharp people on that jury who just weren't going to let the others be asleep at the wheel.
That's true. You know, when we picked this jury, there was this one retired. He was a life insurance salesman, you know, and he was a patrician-looking fella, and we didn't have anything that, you know, from his answers that we could say, hey, let's strike him. Well, lo and behold, you know, I'm not going to bring up any names, and, you know, I'm just going to see if it'll relate to you what one of the jurors told me. That fella was picked as the jury foreman. And lo and behold, you know, when I get up and I ask board our questions of the jury, you know, I ask them about their affiliation with the IRS. I ask them if they had any tax problems, blah, blah, blah. And this particular guy was silent. He never answered those. Well, ultimately, this juror that was on our side, you know, had a big, you know, this was in the last hour before the verdict came back. You know, this juror just flat confronted him, says, hey, man, you've been filling out, you know, he didn't tell us, but apparently he fills out returns for people as a program of the IRS. And this juror concluded, hey, man, you've had some major problem with the IRS, and you never told anybody about it. And, you know, I was surprised about that fact. But, you know, see, that's some of the stuff, you know, even though you ask the questions, there's jurors that are hiding stuff from you.
Yeah, no system is absolutely perfect.
That's true.
You know, but I think Tennessee, we're heading towards the break, so we'll come back and finish this. But, you know, it seems to me that the jurors in Tennessee, especially with all that's been going on in the news with the income tax in Tennessee over the last couple of years, that a jury in Tennessee is probably a bit more friendly to this subject than a jury in, say, Los Angeles.
I would say that you're absolutely correct.
All right, we're heading into the break. I'm Dave Champion, and we'll be right back.
I'll bet that very few of us eat a completely balanced diet. Whether by convenience or personal preference, most of us have acquired unhealthy eating habits. For most cooking, fat is not only essential, it adds a lot of flavor. But our blood vessels become lined with lipids or fats, and this could lead to diabetes, heart disease, or even death. Daniel chapter 1's vascular cleanse naturally burns lipids. The oxidation of fat produces heat and energy. This is known as thermogenesis, and this chemical reaction may make a person experience an unusual hot, itchy feeling. Don't worry, it's temporary, and it means the vascular cleanse is working. So imagine being able to still eat those tasty foods without so much worry. Remember, moderation is still very important. Call 800-504-5511 and order vascular cleanse today. Also ask for the new bio guide. It's a great source of information and inspiration. Call 1-800-504-5511. ARN's program lineup. Weekdays, wake up to American Sunrise with Wyatt Cox. Catch news and commentary on Daybreak USA. Kurt Crosby takes the moral high road on the Feature Hour. Jim and Tricia host Daniel Chapter 1 Health Watch, healing through biomolecular nutrition. True Patriot Jerry Hughes exposes bureaucratic immorality on Straight Talk.
Saturday, Sam Bushman Live with news other networks refuse to use and tech tips for your PC. Supreme Court Attorney Phyllis Schlafly tackles education issues on Radio Live. Second Amendment guru Larry Pratt hosts Live Fire, the No Compromise Gun Lobby on Capitol Hill. Stroll down memory lane on Wyatt's favorite radio. Jerry Hughes brings you America's history and its relation to us today on Conceived in Liberty. Legal savvy Dave Champion helps you fight for your constitutional rights on American Radio. Showtimes are at accentradio.net or call 866-2-ACCENT. Thanks for listening to Accent Radio Network. Professional ball player J.D. Drew uses Daniel Chapter 1's products. This comes as no surprise, as many athletes, amateur and professional, know that biomolecular nutrition is the best for their bodies. All natural nutrients designed to give you back that dominant competitive edge. Biomolecular nutrition is designed for not only the athlete, but also the ill or injured. After a knee operation, AMPM was the preferred drink for JD. You know, being a player for a major league ball team, he's been approached by every so-called nutrition, sports drink, performance enhancer company under the sun. He chose Daniel Chapter 1 because it does the job. There's nothing out there that has the percentage, strength, or efficiency of Daniel Chapter 1's products. So take it from JD Drew. For maximum performance and health on the field or off, Daniel Chapter 1's biomolecular products are the real deal. Call 800-504-5511 and get the new bio guide. That's 800-504-5511.
American Radio, revealing the American Matrix.
And we're back for our final segment with our very special guest, Larry Becraft. Hey, Larry, you want to, we've got some people on the phone. You want to take a call?
Sure.
Okay, great. Keith in Douglasville, Pennsylvania, you're on with Larry Becraft.
Hey, first one up. Thanks. Nice to talk with both of you gentlemen. I spent a lot of time reading what you put over the web, and I appreciate it, and thank you very much. But I have a quick question about why you think more judges don't throw out the willful failure to file scam, which is what I thought Vernice was indicted for, and now I find out that she was not actually, because it was tax evasion. But willful failure to file, if people actually study it, which is section 7203, 55 sections later, where person is defined in section 7343, explicitly explains that it's not you or me. So how does this even get into court, and why don't more attorneys use this?
Well, you know, Keith, let me go ahead and explain it. You know, this whole word problem of involving the tax laws is a complicated one. It's kind of like the people that are running around talking about levies. Well, you know, levies can only be made on government employees. You know, you're reading this is a construction of the code.
Right.
Now, that code section has the word includes in it. And therein lies the big problem, because you can go over to, we have a set of books called Words and Phrases. And in Words and Phrases, I guess there's probably 70 or 75 volumes in Words and Phrases with, you know, big thick old pocket parts. But, you know, all the words, you know, all important legal words, the cases that have construed those, you can find in Words and Phrases. Now, the problem with building arguments based on the word includes is because, you know, there's a wide variety of matters, you know, cases that deal with how the word construed is, the word include is construed. Sometimes it's a word of limitation. Sometimes it's a word of expansion.
Exactly.
You know, and so you have I understand there's a lot of things. You can read the code and you can reach one conclusion. But, you know, the problem with the whole code is that there's a lot of ambiguity, and it is written in such a fashion as to have not one meaning, but several different meanings for any given section of the code. So, well, I don't make arguments unless I can completely pin it down. Well, you know, I don't make arguments just for the sake of making arguments. So, you know, I've never made the 7243 argument regarding the definition of the word person, because, you know, hey, let me just tell you, I know more about the word person than I think anybody involved in the movement. I consider the meaning of the word person. I consider the meaning of the word resident. I mean, the meaning of the word citizen to be very important. But, you know, I see what is talked about in the movement is quite often, you know, beginning impressions.
And I want to let the listeners know that, because Larry and I have talked before privately, and
Larry's done a lot of study into the meaning of words such as person. So when he says he knows more about it than probably just about anybody, he doesn't mean that simply because he's a lawyer. He means that because he's taken the time and effort and spent a good deal of time researching what the word person means. And Larry, if I can sort of repeat something from one of our conversations, Larry feels that that's an argument that needs to be made, but it has to be made in such a way and at such a time and in such circumstances that it is absolutely pinned down and the court can't wiggle out.
Yeah, that's true, Dave. Now, I'll tell you what I have done. You know, I've yet to meet that nobody in government's done this, nobody in America has done this, but I have taken the entire statutes at large and converted them to searchable text, and I have run word searches out of the entire statutes at large. If you want to deal with, you know, if you really want to get down to the word, the person issue, I can tangle with you. You know, I can show you all the places, man. You know, I can pull up 23 statutes at large or 107 statutes at large, and boom, I can, you know, show you where everything is.
But don't you think the people that wrote these laws knew exactly where they were as well?
Yeah, it's real important, you know, but then you also have the problem of, you know, in dealing with the construction of, sometimes words are defined in acts, sometimes they're not. Let me go ahead and address this word person.
Okay. And then I want to follow up with one thing before you let me go.
Go ahead and ask the question. Maybe we can cover it all at once.
Keith, ask quickly. We're running out of time.
Just today I pulled up a couple of Supreme Court cases that were 1995 and one in 2000. You probably know both of these, United States versus Lopez, about the gun within 100 yards
right.
or 100 feet of a school. And the other one, Jones versus United States, was about a Molotov cocktail that was thrown into a home, and the government asserted that it was destruction
of
property.
All this deals with interstate commerce, yeah.
Right,
yep.
Interstate commerce, correct. Well, what the court asserted here was that, and when choice must be made between two readings of what Congress has made a crime, it is appropriate, before choosing the harsher alternative, to require that Congress should have spoken in language that is clear and definite.
All right, and
now,
Keith, on that I'm going to have to let you go because we're down to the very end of the show, and I want Larry to have just a few moments to answer
Thank you very much.
All right, Larry, so go ahead. We've got about a minute. I'm sorry to do that to you.
Well, let me kind of, you know, rather than answering that question, let me make these one comments. You know, Dave, the tax laws are incredibly complex. And the tax movement is, you know, like Keith, our last caller, you know, it's clear that he's digging into these tax issues. You know, but we're going to have some unity in making arguments. What we have in the movement is we got these scattered pockets of people, you know, well, I've got a problem right now, and, you know, I got to do something. You know, we've been behind the power curve in that fashion for, you know, ever since I've been involved in the movement. Unless there is a better organization and a better approach to these legal issues, we're going to be in the same posture that we're in today, 20 years from now. That has to change. There has to be an attitude change on the part of the people that are involved with the movement.
And we've got about 20 seconds. Tell me what you think will change that.
People are going to have to make a decision to contribute more and do more for the restoration of American freedom than what they're doing right now. And let me tell you, I know for a fact that the government is getting ready to, you know, this is coming from scuttlebutt that's come to us. You know, just like in Iraq, there was this shake, rattle, and roll. They're getting ready to do that to the tax movement. So, you know, we need to be ready.
Yes, they are. There's a lot of scuttlebutt about that. Shock and awe, right? And they want to do that now because they're claiming the deficit and the war on terrorism. Larry, we're down to the very end. I want to thank you so much for being here. An hour was not enough. I hope you'll join us another time.
Anytime, Dave. It's always a pleasure to be with you.
All right, Larry. You have a great one.
Same to you.
Thanks so much.
Okay.
This is American Radio, and we'll see you next week.
American Radio, sponsored by Original Intent, produced by Patrick Linstruth. Call screening by Carlos Torres. To comment on today's show, email comments at AmericanRadioShow.us or visit the American Radio Show website at www.AmericanRadioShow.us.
USA Radio Network News, this is Cynthia King. The United States is condemning a car bombing in Iraq. Officials say that they estimate that nearly 100 people have been killed.